It's been 2 years since I left St. Lucie's as pastor. And those of you who were here at the time know that I went off to Presentation Retreat Center, where I've been for the last 2 years, helping with retreats, especially youth retreats, hearing a lot of confessions, and being fairly lazy at times. And then I got kicked out of the retreat center in July. They're selling Presentation Center. I'm hoping and praying they sell it to a Catholic organization so it will continue to function as a retreat center. But I had to make a decision what to do, where to go. And my heart, which was the reason why I resigned as pastor, is much better. So I decided to go back to parish work, and I looked around the diocese to see where some need would be. And over in East San Jose at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish, it's a huge parish, about 5,000 people, that is. 5,000 people come to Mass every Sunday. That's double what come to St. Lucie's. And the majority are Spanish-speaking, and they only have one Spanish-speaking priest. So I thought I could be helpful over there. So I'm now living at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish on East San Antonio Street with my good buddy, Father Gerardo Menchaca, who is the pastor. And one day a week, I serve as spiritual director at St. Patrick's Seminary in Menlo Park. So I just wanted to let you know so you realize I actually am gainfully employed and not totally lazy. This gospel it really hits to the heart of major human troubles. You know, there are cultures where it is almost a law that you are to be vengeful. In these cultures, if your father did something against my father, it's my responsibility to seek revenge against you. It's part of the cultural life. And the revenge can last for generations, like the infamous McCoys and what's the name of those two families? Hatfields and McCoys, that's right. And it's like the Israelis and the Palestinians, it's generation after generation. Just tit for tat, violence and violence against each other. And this is the mentality of terrorists. The last week we had another terror attack, this time in, where was it? London, excuse me. I just spaced out. Yes, London. So we had at least 30 people who were injured. Then the week before, it was in Barcelona, and then, of course, 17 years ago or 16 years ago in New York and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., we had the worst attack ever on American soil from terrorism, and we lost 3,000 innocent people. And here we see the consequences of the belief in revenge. We see the power of hate and resentment to corrupt the human heart. But there's something more powerful, and there's something that can destroy hatred and vengeance. It's called forgiveness. In chapter 18 of Matthew's gospel, Jesus tells us how to deal with hatred and vengeance and resentment. Last Sunday, we read the first part of chapter 18. Today, we read the second part, and you may remember from last Sunday, Jesus says, if your brother sins against you, go and speak alone with your brother. If he listens to you, then you will have won back your brother. So here we see clearly that Jesus is against gossiping about people who have hurt us, murmuring, spreading negative reports about people, even if they're true. He's saying, if you have a problem with someone, go and talk to the person. Don't talk to other people about this individual. Don't talk behind his or her back. Talk directly with the person. No, not in order to condemn the person, but to win over your brother or sister. Today, we hear more in detail about how to deal with problems in the family of the church or our blood family, other communities that we belong to. And what Jesus is proposing to us is that we need to deal with fraternal correction in a way that is different from the way the world deals with it. Because most societies or most small groups, when there's a problem, when there's somebody in the group, in the family, in the church, that's causing problems. The tendency is not to speak directly to the person, but to go over the person's head to the one who has authority to correct. And we believe this avoids confrontation, may appear to be more efficient. For example, in the church, when people don't like what a parishioner is doing, they usually don't talk to the parishioner, they talk to the pastor. And they expect him to solve the problem. Even at St. Lucy's, that might happen from time to time. If they don't like what the pastor is doing, they don't talk to the pastor, they talk to each other about the pastor. Did any of you do that about me when I was here? Or they write a letter to the bishop. And if they don't like what the bishop is doing, what do? They write a letter to the pope. They don't talk to the bishop or try to deal on the local level. And all of this is done for the sake, supposedly, of the good of the person, or the good of the church, or the good of the family. Such actions, as reasonable as they may seem, have nothing to do with Jesus' instructions. Listen to them again. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have won over your brother. If he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, so that every fact may be established on the testimony of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen even to the church, then if he doesn't listen to those two or three, then go to the leader of the church. And if he refuses even to listen to the church, then treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. This passage shows that Jesus wants love and not authority to be primary in our dealings with each other, in particular when we have conflict with each other. And you notice that his concern in this passage is not to scold or punish the brother or sister who sinned against us, but to win over the brother or sister, to reestablish good relationship. But what about that last line, which deals with excommunication? If he refuses to listen even to the church, then treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. This verse seems to mean that those who obstinately refuse to repent of their sin and who disobey the leadership of the church are to be excluded from fellowship in the church community. We call this excommunication. Such an attitude often characterizes church life and family life and the wider society much short of formal excommunication. We can enter into psychological excommunication or emotional excommunication. Notice how we treat people of differing ideologies. After the election of Donald Trump as president, people who voted for Donald Trump or people who voted for Hillary Clinton, I read statistics on this, many, many friendships, like a certain percentage, something like 15% of friendships ended because you voted for Hillary Clinton or you voted for Donald Trump. And so we look at how the attitude of liberals toward conservatives or conservatives toward liberals, they often write each other off. They condemn the other side. And these examples reflect psychological and emotional excommunication that we assign to each other when we encounter views that we find repugnant. Or what is more serious, don't we often feel a hostility toward people who have hurt us? A hostility that we nurse within us and which builds up a wall. What does Jesus teach about excommunication in chapter 18 of Matthew? Verse 17, he says, if this obstinate person, this person who's hurting the family or hurting the local community or hurting the church, refuses to listen even to the church, then treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. Now, what would this statement mean to Matthew, who's writing the gospel? Matthew, who wrote roughly in the 70s or 80s of the first century, who at the end of his gospel reports Jesus' instruction to the apostles to go out to all the Gentiles of the world and evangelize them. And in the same gospel, Jesus shows particular interest in reaching out to a tax collector named Matthew. In other words, even though an arrogantly sinful member of the family or the church who refuses to repent, someone who's really causing chaos, really causing a great deal of damage to the community, sometimes we have to use tough love and say, I'm sorry. You know, I love you, I care about you, but you are really creating havoc with our family, with our community, with our church. Sometimes we have to do that, you know, at Thanksgiving. I have a good buddy who has a sister who's an alcoholic who refuses to admit she's an alcoholic. And every time she comes to a family gathering, she creates nothing but chaos. So finally, my friend, who really loves his sister, said to her, look, I really care for you, but you are creating chaos every time you come to a family gathering. And I'm sorry to tell you, you can't come to Thanksgiving dinner. You are not welcome in my house until you're willing to deal with your disease. She wasn't too happy to hear that. But it was tough love. And it was a type, you could say, of excommunication. And so the same thing is true very rarely, but occasionally in the church. Someone is just, you know, creating havoc in the church or completely disregarding church teaching and obstinately opposed to it. You have to say, I'm sorry, you cannot serve in a ministry if you're giving that kind of witness to people around you. So that sometimes is necessary. But even in those cases, someone who refuses to admit their mistakes, refuses to repent, and they have to be excluded for a while from the community, aren't we supposed to continue to reach out to that person in imitation of a Jesus who so regularly sought out tax collectors and sinners that he was accused of what? What was the accusation against Jesus, one of which led him to be crucified? What was the accusation? Mark Barbieri, you're a biblical scholar. Come on, tell us. They accused him of being a friend of sinners and tax collectors and prostitutes. That was one of the accusations that led to Jesus being condemned. Now, my interpretation is not unique to me. This interpretation is supported by the next section of this chapter 18 concerning the ongoing forgiveness of the brother or sister who sins. So you remember in answer to Peter's question, how many times do I need to forgive? 7 times. And Jesus tells the extravagant story about a king who settled accounts with his servants. One servant owed the king 10,000 talents. That's the original Greek. A talent was worth, you know, thousands of dollars. So we're talking about millions of dollars was owed to this king by a servant. The king canceled the whole debt. The lesson that Jesus draws, forgive 70 times 7 times, meaning an unlimited number of times. Doesn't his answer imply that forgiveness must pursue relentlessly the repudiated brother or sister and not simply wait around for him to come crawling and asking for forgiveness? So what's the conclusion? We have to maintain the tension between tough love, protecting a family, protecting the local community against very disruptive or hostile behavior, and always wanting to reach out to that person who's causing the problems, as indicated by Jesus' approach to the Gentiles and the tax collectors. If it comes down to serious divisions between ourselves and others, we need to pray for the grace of Jesus' attitude towards the Gentiles and the tax collectors. In that way, we can avoid what Jesus defines as an unforgivable sin, namely, to be unforgiving.